This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kusha Navadar in for Allison Stewart, who is currently on medical leave. The great American novel is a term that gets thrown around a lot and has inspired some consensus, but also a lot of controversy. The term was coined in 1868 by a writer named John William DeForest, who proposed a new kind of novel, a, quote, picture of the ordinary emotions and manners of American existence. But what does it actually mean? And how do you capture the soul of a nation as vast and diverse as the United States in several hundred pages? Well, The Atlantic magazine has now tried its hand at defining the idea, coming up with a list of 136 novels that features The Great Gatsby, Catcher in the Rye, Charlotte's Web, The Bell Jar, Beloved, The Secret History, and one book from last year. According to the editors, this list includes 45 debut novels, 9 winners of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and 3 children's books. 12 were published before the introduction of the mass market paperback to America, and 24 after the release of the Kindle. At least 60 books have been banned by schools or libraries. Joining me now is Atlantic senior editor Gaul Beckman. Welcome to All of It.
Hey, great to be here.
Great to have you. And listeners, what is your great American novel? What do you think of as the canon? Call or text us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can message us on social at allofitwnyc. Have you read the Atlantic's lists? What did you agree with? What did you disagree with? What questions do you have for Gaul? What do you want to call us out on? Call 212-433-9692. Okay, Gaul, the great American novel is an idea that's attributed to a 19th century essay from John William DeForest, which we just quoted. Can you give us a little more context about where this idea of the great American novel comes from?
Sure. Well, it's really telling that it sort of emerges in the mid 19th century, right after the Civil War, right? Because America has just experienced this existential crisis coming out of it. The country is sort of coming back together to some extent. And the idea is, could a novel, could this form, you know, that had really developed and gained prominence in the 19th century sort of capture the experience of being an American, sort of writ large? I think the answer is no.
Why is that?
Because, you know, one novel can't really do that. And the point of having a list with 136 books is that, you know, it's the totality of those books that tells us something about the great American novel. If you are somebody who loves fiction or somebody who writes, you know that if you enter into, you know, an endeavor like writing a novel with a big idea like I'm going to tell the entire American story, you're probably going to fail.
Yeah, or write a very long book. Yes. A very long book. Can you unpack a little bit what that term, great American novel, kind of meant back in the day, back in the 19th century, and maybe how it's evolved since then up to this list that you put out?
Well, I don't think that there are many writers who have actually attempted to do the great American novel. I mean, I was thinking about our list this morning, and there's like 2 novels that stand out. We could talk about them if you'd like, that I think I can kind of see that the writers were really trying to do this. But basically, it's understanding that we live in America in this incredibly diverse, you know, society that's stratified in all kinds of different ways, where there are, you know, myths that we aspire to, that drive us, that motivate us. There's realities that we sort of have to deal with, disillusions that many people have about the dream of America versus the reality of America. There's all this great big stew of sort of ideas and experiences that constantly are remaking themselves, you know, in America, with new populations that come in, new people that have their perspective on what it means to be an American. So could a novel, this form that sort of allows for incredible interiority, but also can do a panorama, you know, can tell you a story that takes place, you know, over a long period of time or in the minds of many different people, could that form actually encompass something as big as telling us what America is?
We're talking to Gaul Bechmann about the great American novel, specifically a list that The Atlantic just came out with of 136 books that fall under their definition of the great American novel. And we want to know from you listening right now, which books under that classification exist for you? What do you consider to be your great American novel that you love to read? Call or text us 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So can we go into the criteria a little bit?
Yeah, what was sure. The criteria that I think that's really important because we limited ourselves to the last 100 years. Mm. Why did we do that? We did it because we felt like 100 years is a period of time where the canon is still in flux, where people are still making decisions about what's going to last, what are we going to be reading in 50 years, in 100 years, in 200 years. A 100-year period of time looking back from today to 1925, there's a lot of fluidity. Before that, if we went further back, it might not be so surprising. Moby Dick is going to be on there. Huckleberry Finn's going to be on there. There's a certain set number of books that people can already imagine have sort of, they're already in the Mount Rushmore of the American canon. So it seemed much more interesting and honestly much more fun to say, let's start with a period of time where we don't really know. I mean, there clearly are a number of books on this list that everyone could have predicted would be on the list. A book like Great Gatsby, a book like Invisible Man, one of my favorites. But there's a lot of books that you could not predict, and the surprise of sort of putting books on there that maybe, we wanted to elevate a little bit, hadn't gotten a lot of attention, in their time, but have over time kind of come to be seen as important books, or sort of widen the angle, so we take in books by writers and by populations that hadn't gotten the kind of recognition or mainstream recognition at the time. We really wanted to sort of find a perfect balance between a list that would kind of make us be read as legitimate, like the because The Great Gatsby is on there, but also where you'd uncover things that or discover books that you maybe had never heard about.
Legitimate is an interesting word. Can you unpack that a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, people approach a list like this and they say, okay, well, so The Atlantic's going to do, going to tell us what the canon is. And so if you leave off The Great Gatsby, you're taking a risk of people sort of writing off. I mean, I happen to think it's an incredible book. Most people do. But if you leave off a book like that just for the sake of provocation, like you're also undermining the authority of the list as a list that's trying to capture this last 100 years. The interesting part to me is sort of putting The Great Gatsby next to a book for example, we have a book on there from 1937, a novel called East Goes West by a writer named Yang Hil Kang, which most people have not heard of. He was the first Korean-American novelist. And he's writing a book about an immigrant who comes to America. It's sort of this picaresque story. He becomes like a traveling salesman and sort of sees America in the 1930s, becomes fairly disillusioned. But it's from an Asian-American perspective, an immigrant perspective, that most people don't know that book. So to have that right next to The Great Gatsby, that I think is the sort of dynamic that we were going for.
It's interesting. The East Goes West, the novelist and journalist Ed Park wrote the blurb for this book in your article, and he calls it the rare sequel that eclipses its predecessor. How many sequels were on the list?
I don't know numbers off the top of my head, but there's quite a number of, I think you gave us the number of debut novels. There's, the other thing that we wanted to do, just in terms of our thinking about how to compose this was there's a lot of novelists that have become sort of iconic during this last 100-year period, but we maybe know one book from them, and so we wanted to sort of open that up a little bit and say maybe it's the wrong book, or not the wrong book, but maybe there's another book that we can draw attention to that might be more interesting, that tells people a story that they haven't heard before, and then there's novelists like a Philip Roth or a Toni Morrison where, we knew they were going to be on the list probably with multiple books, but then how do you choose which books, you put on there?
We have a text from a from a listener who just said, how do I access this list? Is it in the current Atlantic issue? I feel like that's good table setting. Where can people actually find this list?
Online. If you go to theatlantic.com, it should be right there on our homepage. If you can't find it, you can click down on our drop-down menu, go to books, and you can find it there.
You had mentioned earlier that there were two standout books that you thought kind of fit that general definition of what the great American novel is. Can you pick out one of them right now and talk about it?
Sure. I mean, the books I'm thinking of when I was sort of doing this exercise in my own mind were Saul Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, both of which came out, one of them 1952, the other one 1953. They strike me as books where the author set out to tell the story of America, you know? I mean, I'm sure there's other authors on this list who had that same ambition. But it's interesting to me that both of these authors did it at that moment, which is sort of this post-war period in America. You know, much like we talked earlier about when the idea of the great American novel comes about, you know, in the post-Civil War, this is another sort of hinge moment in America, right? It's America sort of, people are returning from war. A lot of the social structures have been sort of scrambled by war, you know, for women, for African Americans. And it is sort of a moment of fluidity, of flux, where a writer can say, let me see if I can wrap my arms around all of it. And you can sort of sense them trying to do that.
Do you find that the country being in a moment of flux elicits that kind of objective with authors based on when they had come up as authors and what they experienced? Or do you think that it's just coincidence and that's where we're going to look because we were in flux at that time?
No, I think that it provides what a storyteller needs, which is tension, right? I mean, we have so many fantastic novels on this list by immigrants or children of immigrants for similar reasons, which is they are encountering a new country. There's this inherent drama, inherent tension, and it renews itself with every generation. So you have Yang He-Kang, you know, in the 1930s doing it, but then you have Gary Steingart, you know, in the 90s writing about being a Russian, you know, Jew and coming to America. So there are these sort of tropes, you know, and one of them, I mean, tropes in the sense that there are these moments or inherent tensions that give rise to the novel or a novel. And you can sort of, you can see them over time. And I think, you know, the 50s is obviously a big moment, the 60s as well. Yeah,
absolutely. We're talking to Gaul Beckman, who's senior editor at The Atlantic, and The Great American Novels is the list they just came out. You can talk to us right now, listeners, about what you consider to be the great American novels in your life. Call us or text us 212-433-9692. And we can go to a caller right now, Robin in Harlem. Hi, Robin.
Hey, thanks for doing this segment. I confess I was pretty skeptical about a greatest list because it's always flawed, but it's actually pretty impressive. I would suggest one missing work, which is The Memory of Old Jack by Wendell Berry. It's the kind of book, I've probably read it four times over the last 25 years, and I get something else out of it every time, but the writing is gorgeous. The story is gentle but compelling and powerful, and it definitely reflects something about America. So I just want to put that into the running here, but it's otherwise, I got to say, I'm impressed with your list.
Robin,
good on you.
Thank you so much for calling. So we got some fans there.
Thank you so much. You know, we kind of put the list out in order to like start a fight. Like that was a big part of this. But it also is incredibly reassuring to hear people feel like it sort of, you know, that it works for them. And Wendell Berry is incredible. And you're totally right. He could have been on this list. I know that book well. And it's a beautiful book.
Were there any books that you really were fighting over? Or maybe if you don't want to point out this specific book, were there any, you mentioned tensions in the story of the United States. Were there any tensions in that editor's room where there were certain themes or certain books that really you were fighting tooth and nail to get in but just didn't make it?
There were definitely, you know, I mean, all done with a spirit of great congeniality.
Of course.
But but we definitely fought and argued and debated over which one should be in, which one shouldn't be in, you know, and a little bit also of proportions, you know, how much of this, how much of that. I don't know if I want to talk about specific books, you know, but there were definitely, you know, somebody asked me the other day about To Kill a Mockingbird, which is not on the list. And I remember the day where we were sort of like, should we take To Kill a Mockingbird off, you know, because it's such a classic book. It's a book that many people read themselves and in middle school. It's like it's still being read in middle school. You know, Harper Lee is kind of an iconic, you know, American writer in some ways. But this was the process of doing this list, which is we sort of went back and said, you know, do people really, is the book really the thing that stands out or sort of the cultural trace that it's left, including the movie that came after it? And when we went back to the book, we felt, this is going to start a fight, but we felt like maybe the literary quality was not as, you know, something that we thought might last, you know, that it told this wonderful morality tale at a moment where Americans maybe needed to hear it. But is it a book that people are going to read in 100 years? And in that moment, in that room, arguing over it, we came to the decision, maybe not.
Is that mostly opinion with biases, or are there certain tangible, objective things that you can look at to try to determine that on a piece of art?
I mean, it's all subjective. Yeah. I mean, we have the authority of being people who spend a lot of time with books. You know, that's what I do every day. I will add, you know, and I don't think we mentioned this yet, but I did not want to just go into a room with my colleagues and decide what the great American novels were. That was never going to be something that I wanted to be a part of. But what we decided was we would call on experts. Mm-hmm. So we went out to this incredible panel of novelists and critics and academics who study American literature, and we asked them each for their five books that they would, you know, kind of push upon somebody, you know, from the last 100 years. And we threw that into a pot. And then we started to stir, and we called, and we just added other books that, you know, but we started off by asking people who really spend a lot of time thinking about writing and about American writing in particular, everyone from Henry Louis Gates Jr. to some wonderful contemporary novelists like Gary Steingart, but also Katie Kitamura, Rumana Alam, you know, people who have strong feelings about, you know, the books that they love. And that was great. I mean, that really gave us, it added to that sense of authority also. Yeah.
Yeah, that sense of legitimacy that we were
exactly,
talking about.
Exactly.
Well, there's a lot of books to dive into, and
yes,
we have a lot of calls with opinions, so we might be having a little bit of tension in the room in a bit. We're going to take a quick break. I am joined by Gall Beckerman, senior editor at The Atlantic. The Atlantic just put out a list of the great American novels. We will hear from you right after this. Give us a call, 212-433-9692. More right after this. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kusha Navidar in for Allison Stewart, and we're joined by Gall Beckerman, who's senior editor at The Atlantic. The Atlantic just came out with their list of the great American novels. We've been talking about it, and listeners, we want to hear from you. What do you consider to be the great American novel in your own life? Call us or text us, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And we just heard from The Atlantic very graciously. They've put a free link for this article to us, so we're putting that free link on our website. Anyone can go read the article without subscription by going to the All of It episode and segment page. So, Gall, on behalf of WNYC, thank you to The Atlantic.
Of course.
We appreciate that. So, listeners, we want to hear from you. What is your great American novel? We've got a caller right now, David in Brooklyn. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. It was nice of you to take my call. As far as the great American novel goes, kind of a curveball here, but my favorite author happens to be John Updike, and I adore Couples. And that was really a book that turned heads when it was new. And when you consider the decade that it debuted during, I mean, the 60s was, you know, it was all over the place. And you talk about the great American novel. That novel seemed almost bigger when you're reading it. It felt almost bigger than America. The fact that these characters look at these major events like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Kennedy assassination, and it was just like, you know, the backdrop of their lives. Like, oh, that's happening. Well, let's get back to our lives. Like, it was something that caught a lot of people off guard. And yeah, it kind of raised the conversations about how to approach sex in fiction, especially in American fiction.
David, thank you so much for bringing that up. Lots of big ideas that you just brought up there. One is the story that is, would you say, bigger than America? Is that, did I hear that correctly? And bringing in the idea of sex in fiction. Yeah. So what do you think of when you hear that?
Well, first of all, Couples is on our list. Yeah. So, and I smiled when David said that, because there was actually a very heated debate in our office about which Updike should be on the list. That we had a real Updike aficionado on the staff who believed that it should be one of the Rabbit Run. If you know Updike's work, he did a series of books about a character named Rabbit Armstrong. But we decided to do Couples, and it actually does point to one of the other sort of criteria that we were looking at, which is, you know, a book that does something that really feels new, that really has like a freshness to it. In this case, the way that Updike was writing about sex and capturing sort of the spirit of the sexual revolution at the time. So, you know, sometimes a book sort of stood out to us because it was stylistically doing something very innovative. You know, the other thing about this 100-year period that we looked at is it sort of begins with where modernism is sort of cresting, and in literature sort of opens up in all these different sort of ways. You know, you have the whole postmodernist sort of experimental movements that, you know, that happened throughout the 20th century. You have this great explosion of, you know, wonderfully sort of sophisticated genre fiction, I would say. Mm. You know, I mean, Stephen King is on this list. You know, we tried to, Judy Blume is on this list. You know, there's books that, so Couples is a book that, you know, caught our attention because it really felt that I was sort of Updike meeting the moment and doing something that felt really new. Yeah.
And to that point, there are some great books which might not make this list because of the criteria. So at this point, I want to bring in Silke from Brooklyn. Hi, Silke. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Awesome. So I stumbled across, I mean, I don't know, this is not really fiction, but when I was in my teens, I came across Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, which for me is really like this kind of quintessential American novel, because it sort of, I mean, what did it do? I mean, it sort of opened up this whole genre of writing, which was taking nonfiction and weaving it into this sort of like a novel sort of approach, you know, this new way of writing, and it's very fictionalized. You know, this felt like the story was just really unfolding, and it was, you know, about American violence, sort of on the cusp of real violence in America. 1959, I think he wrote it. I think it was published in 66. I'm not positive, but I mean, it opened up this whole way of looking at the American dream, you know, working hard versus greed, the serial killers, you know, thrill kill killers, you know, just spur of the moment killers. This sort of whole world was sort of unfolding at the time. And then how Truman Capote, you know, went about gathering this information and weaving it into this kind of felt like a fiction novel, but it.
Yeah, Silke, thank you so much for bringing that up. And so, In Cold Blood, Truman Capote.
Oh, man, we had such debates about In Cold Blood. It was a real conflict.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, including myself, really love that book. But we had to sort of, you know, this is a list of novels. So nonfiction sort of, by definition, was not going to make the list. In Cold Blood is complicated because Capote is using sort of fictional techniques. There is some indication sort of post facto that he made up a lot of stuff in that book to make it as fictional or as novel seeming as it is. But where we sort of like came down in terms of our judgment was looking at how Capote himself described it. And he really thought about it as a piece of journalism. He wanted it to be presented as nonfiction. You know, in spite of, you know, the literary qualities that have kind of make it seem almost like a novel. And so, certainly if we did a list of the greatest creative nonfiction, you know, of the last 100 years, which we could do, and I hope we do one day, like that would be a no-brainer.
We got a text as well from a listener who was asking or talking about I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, similar situation with that
memoir.
Book. Yeah, memoir. So it's off the table.
Yeah, there were a few memoirs that were just, you know, and also it appeared a time when people thought about memoirs a little bit differently. They sort of thought about memoirs the way we think of autofiction now, which is, you know, or rather, you know, something that would be called a memoir, you know, 60 years ago might be called a novel, like of an autofictional novel, along the lines of a Ben Lerner or Rachel Cusk, if people know those writers, you know, where they're sort of taking the material of their own life, writing about it in a what seems to be a very autobiographical way, but it's supposed to be, you know, read by a reader as fiction. But memoirs weren't thought of that way 50, 60 years ago. They were thought of as the truth of a person's life. And so they really do fall out of the category of a novel as we would think about it today.
Yeah. Well, here's a novel that we would love to bring up from Sharon in Queens. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? You know, I read Native Son by Richard White. I read it when I was in high school, and it wasn't debated then because I went to all-white high school. I'm black. And so it was just like a piece of literary that we had to get through. But then I read it again in college, and it was fire. Then I read it again when I was 25. For a master's degree. Then I read it again when I was 40, and I'm 70. I read it again when I was 50 at a book club. And every time we read this book, it sparks so much talk and discussion because it was published in the 1940s. And it still resonates on all the bigger, the main character. Was he a character? Was he a real person? A lot of debate, but it still resonates that I can probably read it tomorrow and still get something else from it.
Sharon, thank you so much for bringing up that really, I think, integral part of what makes a great novel is that you read at different stages of your life and you take something new from it, right, Gaul?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, I think that was, and Native Son is an incredible book. And it's not hard to imagine people reading that book in 100 years from now. Both because of its literary merit sort of on its own, but also the picture that it gives us of, you know, what it means to be African-American. Yeah. You know, it has these dimensions to it, these emotional dimensions and these literary dimensions. And it's also just a really good story. It's a good book to read.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, you know, Native Son was like a book in the Book of the Month Club in 1940 when it came out, which was it's pretty shocking to consider that it was a popular book when it actually was first published, in spite of some pretty, some pretty incendiary themes. Yeah.
Incendiary is a perfect word to segue. First of all, Sharon, thank you so much for that
thank
call.
You.
Incendiary, your article notes at least 60 books on the list have been banned by schools or libraries. That's nearly half the list.
Yeah.
Does that say anything to you?
I mean, there's two ways to look at that. You know, one is to feel bad about the state of of American culture that we can classify a book as something that should be off limits to somebody. On the other way of looking at it, the more positive way is like how much power these books have. You know, they have so much power that people who are afraid of their contents have to ban them. I think, you know, we in making this list, we're obviously celebrating those books, and we are saying that, you know, the first thing people need to do is actually read them. So being able to have access is a really important thing.
We are getting some texts about unhappy folks.
Oh, they,
yeah, okay.
No, I want the unhappy folks.
Well, here you go. Some folks are really unhappy about the exclusion of Barbara Kingsolver. Any comments about that?
I don't know that I have anything specific to say about that. I know that her name came up. We were trying to find the novel that we would want to put on there, and for any number of reasons, because lots of things got sort of etched out, we couldn't find the one that we all felt on the same page about.
So if you think about it being 100 years ago, that was the start date, what do you think we lose by not extending it back? We had talked about legitimacy, but are there other elements of novels from more than 100 years ago that you think haven't been captured in this list?
Sure. I mean, well, first of all, the 19th century is like the great era of the social novel, the big social novel, you know, that, I mean, we have a little bit of that with Theodore Dreiser, who's in the An American Tragedy, which is one of the first books on the list in 1925. But he you know, the novel sort of takes a different direction at that point. It doesn't, you know, we don't have these big sort of capacious, you know, stories that kind of have like multiple characters. I mean, there are some of them, but the 19th century was really the moment for that. And also, you know, some of the energy of the Civil War, if we're looking at American novels, some of the energy of the Civil War and sort of what that did to America. So we're, you know, we don't have Melville on here. We don't have, for one, we don't have Mark Twain. You know, those are novelists that, you know, or Stephen Crane, you know, these are novelists that over time sort of really came to understand what those divisions were, you know, help explain what those divisions were.
Are there any other standout, is there one more standout book that you would like to tell readers, like, this was one that I felt very passionately about making on the list and it's in there?
Oh man, there's so many. It's hard to pick out. I mean, you know, there's a few of my own personal favorite. I'm a big Philip Roth fan. I you know, so we had to decide which Philip Roth is going to be on here. And we went with Portnoy's Complaint because it had sort of, it did kind of, like John Updike's Couples, it did something kind of interesting and new with the novel. But Sabbath Theater is one of my favorite books from 1995. Mm-hmm. that we put on there. Other books that sort of stand out to me, you know, we wanted to capture the whole movement of noir books, you know, but we wanted to do it in a slightly unusual, or not unusual, but in a way that will feel fresh to readers. So we have a book on here by Dorothy Hughes, who's a not super well-known writer in that form. It's called In a Lonely Place, which is sort of a very early sort of serial killer novel, but tells really a fascinating story of, you know, it's Los Angeles, you know, just post-war, a veteran fighter pilot, you know, returns and starts, you know, stalking the city, like preying on women, and it's sort of the unraveling of his predation.
Well, there are a lot of books that you can look at on this list. If listeners, you're interested in finding out more or you would like to read the list yourself, The Atlantic has been kind enough to put a link to the article free on our website. So you can go to all of its website, click on the link there and see the full list of 136 books. And if you want to find out more, Gall Beckerman will be speaking in conversation about the great American novels at The Strand on Wednesday, April 3rd at 7 p.m. For tickets, you can head to strandbooks.com/events. Great American Novels, Gall Beckerman, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us and for coming out with this list.
Thank you. And thanks for all the listeners who called in. It was lovely to hear the suggestions.
Absolutely.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.